Maryland Representative Dutch Ruppersberger is ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee. Last week, that committee issued its final report on the terrorist attack on the U.S. compound at Benghazi in 2012. It found no intelligence failure, as Republicans have alleged, and put to rest several rumors about the deaths of Christopher Stevens, the U.S. ambassador to Libya, and three others. Dutch Ruppersberger was co-author of that bipartisan report. He joins us this hour to talk about it. We'll also hear what he has to say about the Senate's recent block of a bill aimed at ending the National Security Agency's bulk collection of telephone records. Also on the agenda, President Obama's executive orders on immigration, the recent midterm elections, and the Ferguson decision. Dutch Ruppersberger on Midday after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here for the second hour. Thank you again for joining us on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick in Hagerstown, WYPO Ocean City and the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And we're streaming live online through our website, too, WYPR.org. You can catch podcasts later in the day if you miss the show when we're live. 410-662-8780 is the phone number here for live talk. Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger is with us now. In Studio A, Dutch Ruppersberger represents Maryland's 2nd Congressional District. Now, that includes Baltimore County, parts of Baltimore County, Howard County, Harford County.
Howard County.
I said Harford County. I said it all.
Baltimore City.
Parts of Baltimore City.
It's the Baltimore region.
It's nice to see you again, Congressman. We just finished an hour of discussion about the grand jury's decision in Missouri yesterday not to indict the police officer Darren Wilson in the shooting of the unarmed teenager Michael Brown. It's a big story in the news, and lots of people talking about this today. So I thought I'd start off by asking you about this. You used to be a prosecutor.
Yeah, I was a former prosecutor. Look, we have the best system of justice, I believe, in the country. I travel a lot in my role on intelligence. It doesn't mean the system always works, and but it's the best system that we have, and we also need to have a rule of law. And we don't need to break laws when we disagree with something. It's a very unfortunate situation. I understand that people can be very upset when they think things are not right, when they think that there's an injustice. But that's the rule of law we have. I don't know all the facts that were put out. The grand jury system. When I was a prosecutor, we take cases to the grand jury. It's not the test of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It's the first phase. It's like the charging phase. And you present evidence to your grand jury. In this situation, I'm not sure of the makeup of the grand jury or what happened.
I can tell you what the makeup was.
What was the makeup?
There's 12 members of the grand jury in Missouri. They need 9 to agree to bring an indictment. And the racial makeup was 9 whites and 3 blacks.
Well, I'm surprised at that because of the population is majority, I believe, African American.
Of Ferguson itself,
Is that because the people who have filed to vote, the registered voters, because that's where you get the individuals, is that because they're more higher percentage of white that are registered voters?
I don't understand. In the state of Missouri, maybe so.
Yeah, but usually it's your local county, the way it is in Maryland.
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
I don't know. I don't know. Don't have that at hand here, how they decided to compose this. My question was, going back to your prosecutor
days. Let me say one thing before that.
Right.
Other than that, I think that what Michael Brand's father said, I really respect what he said. Right. We don't want to hurt our neighborhood. And the most important thing he said is make change, not noise. And he was reaching out. Don't hurt our community. Don't tear down our community. It's a bad situation, but let's move forward. Make up a police department. Reaching out the hearts and minds of people. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. It's just this is such a volatile subject because of the racial aspect of it and because of the power that was used seems to be disproportionate to whatever offense Michael Brown might have committed.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I don't know. You might know more about the facts than I do. I know most of the facts that I've received from the media. I know when I was a Baltimore County executive, a lot that we did was train our police officers. And I give an example that I was very proud of Baltimore County Police. that there was a police officer that got a call on a domestic situation in a car, and there might be shots fired. This police officer went up to the car. He saw that the wife had been shot. It was a husband-wife domestic situation. The man had a gun. And normally in other jurisdictions, this man would have had 10 bullets. This police officer got control of the man, cuffed him, got 911 before backup came. That was good training, and that's important. Also, what I see in police work, and it's important that we do have to have justice in our streets, and the rule of law is important, but police officers need training, and it's just not training on how to use equipment and guns and that type of thing, but it's also how to communicate and reach people, get information, stop a problem before it starts. That's what we do in the POW program in our schools. And until we start doing that, you need confidence of especially what's happening in Ferguson. You need confidence of people that don't have confidence in the police system anymore. And that's why you're having these problems.
One last question on this for you. Now, if callers have a question for Dutch Ruppersberger on this, feel free to call. We have several other topics to get to.
Got a lot of them.
Yeah. That expression, any prosecutor can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. I mean, you've heard this before. Do you think that's true?
It depends on the prosecutor and the case. All I know, again, media reports, is that this prosecutor, instead of trying to influence...
I mean, as a general rule. Going back to your days could you talk a grand jury into indicting somebody?
Well, what you usually do, if you have the case before you, you read the facts. And you have the police report, and you read the facts. But most good prosecutors will review the facts before you even go to the grand jury or have an indictment, because there's no sense in prosecuting somebody if you're going to lose the case in the court of law. Where the test is, you have to prove somebody guilty beyond a reasonable doubt to a moral certainty. And that's a high test. So, you know, it's more about going to trial. And as I said, good prosecutors, I work for Sandy O'Connor, we wouldn't take a case that we thought we would lose, even though the person might have been guilty.
This case would have been built heavily on eyewitness testimony.
Yeah, and it would have been a jury trial, and it would have been a tough case. But again, I'm not going to make judgments on the case. I don't know enough about the facts other than what I've seen in the media.
Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger is our guest for this hour of midday. If you have a question for him, 410-662-8780. Late last week, the final report from the House Intelligence Committee on the 2-year investigation into the attack at Benghazi, Libya. 2012 at the diplomatic compound in Libya, where the U.S. ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens, was killed along with three others. So you co-authored this report. It's a bipartisan report.
Totally bipartisan.
Yeah.
By the way, on our intelligence committee, it's a small committee.
Yeah.
We had the chairwoman of the Tea Party, Michelle Bachmann, on the committee, and we had some people from the far left on our side.
Okay.
So it was a totally bipartisan.
First of all, let's tell the listeners what the conclusion was, because you look specifically at whether there was an intelligence failure in the scenario in the lead up to this terrorist attack at Benghazi. You concluded that there was no intelligence failure.
Yes, we did. We had for over 2 years, we conducted an exhaustive investigation of the incident. We spent thousands of hours asking questions, poring over documents, reviewing intelligence assessments, reading cables and emails. We held a total of 20 committee events and hearings. We conducted detailed interviews with senior intelligence officials from Benghazi and Tripoli, as well as 8 security personnel on the ground in Benghazi that night. And based on this testimony and documents reviewed, we concluded that all the CIA officers in Benghazi were heroes and their actions saved lives. We also concluded that there was no intelligence failure to the attacks, but the early intelligence assessments and the administration's public narrative on the causes and motivations for the attack were not fully accurate. And a mixed group of individuals, including those affiliated with al-Qaeda, participated in the attacks. Finally, the committee found no evidence that the CIA conducted any unauthorized activities in Benghazi, and the CIA did not intimidate any officer or otherwise dissuade them from telling their stories to Congress.
All right. Let's go back a step there. Yep. Where did you find fault with the administration for the statements that Susan Rice put out after the
that was it? That's what really I think started the controversy.
Mm-hmm.
That was a couple years ago. We had new people on the intelligence committee. There are only 21 of us, and I'm in leadership there, and I'm the one that asked for the talking points, and I get teased about it all the time. And why I did, I said it was the head of CIA was giving us a briefing. It just happened. And I said, well, I know there's going to be a lot of media, and we have to be worried about giving out classified information. Could you give us unclassified talking points that we that our members can respond to the media? Well, what happens a lot in government generally, the talking points became bigger than life. They had to go through 10 different people. But the talking points they put together the first couple days were given to Susan Rice. She relied on those talking points, and she ended up going on national Sunday talk shows, like
a lot of
us do in this
regard. That's the only place where you find fault with what happened?
Yeah, and the way that the talking points were developed.
What about adequate protection for the diplomatic compound? Did you get into that?
Well, for the first phase, because we were focusing on CIA and their role in the intelligence, as far as the State Department was concerned, the compound was not where it should have been. But they hire – usually the State Department, and this is almost in any country, hires people from the country to provide a lot of the security. But they did have some of their own security who are well-trained individuals. And so we found at that point, we just looked at it, that a lot of times we had these individuals, when the attacks actually started, ran and left the place. But what we did find is that the security officer who was American and who was really in charge of the ambassador's safety did the right thing. You have in any American compound like this, you have a safe room. And these safe rooms have saved lives in other parts of the world, including Pakistan and that type of thing. What happened in this situation, though, extremely unfortunate, and we've dealt with it now, is that when they saw that this was getting out of hand, the security person took the press person and the ambassador into the safe room. The safe room was not constructed properly, and smoke got in. So the safe room was not a safe room. So they knew they had to get out quick, and what happened, they crawled on the floor, and the security person leading the charge, the other two were behind them, and they just were succumbed by the smoke, and that's what occurred. Then the calls came to the other compound, which was controlled by the CIA. And at that point, you have the call, we need help. There was about a 20-minute delay, which was the appropriate way, and this is something we found, a 20-minute delay on the head of the CIA at that point, that compound, who had to provide for the security. And he had to make a decision whether we go right away, do we need backup. He called for backup, and the unfortunate—
I mean, there were two locations.
There was two locations.
Right.
There was the first location, and then there was a CIA location. And the CIA was responsible for the security and for that location. They got the call. They needed help, and what happened when that person received that information that they needed help? He first wanted to find out what the situation was, do the due diligence, what do we need to do, and ask for help and ask for equipment too, more firepower, because he knew there was a problem. That was 20 minutes. That's all. And that was made a big deal, which is unfortunate.
Republicans have made a big deal out of this.
Right.
I think because they want to use it against Hillary Clinton should she decide to run for president in 2016. That's pretty obvious. But here, you know, I pick up the New York Times on Friday. And here we have a bipartisan report concluding that the Obama, you know, basically Obama administration didn't do anything really wrong here in terms of there was no intelligence failure. If anything, it was the talking points problem.
That was what
so
started.
You have Republican and Democrats agreeing on this report, right? And then we get to Sunday.
And also there were allegations made that we were told to stand down, which, by the way, there were other investigations. The Armed Services Committee, bipartisan, said there was no military stand down.
Right.
The person who said in 20 minutes we're going to go to protect our Americans at that time, going into a bad situation, 20 minutes, that was the amount of time. That's no stand down. And then I personally interviewed the people on the ground who wrote the books, and there was absolutely no allegations that there was any problem, no stand down, we can't go, any of that situation.
Okay. Why do we get to Sunday then, the Sunday talk shows this week, and Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, senator, used a very harsh, it's not an appropriate word for any politician to be using, I guess. He called it garbage, but he used some other word.
He used crap.
He used the word crap. I just don't think that's, you know, it's not so bad, but it's not something... it says something about political discourse today when a senator uses a word like that on a Sunday talk show. But whatever. What do you make of him?
Well,
what do you make of him dismissing this bipartisan report?
I'm extremely disappointed at his comments, whether he used the word crap or whether he attacked the report without even reading it, because I understand on the show he hadn't even read the report. This was 2,000 hours. This was a bipartisan report, Republicans and Democrats, liberal and conservative and moderates on this committee. And we did was follow the facts. And if crap equals facts, that's not the case. Unfortunately, sometimes people have a reputation and they're on media a lot. And, you know, I just think we're a lot better off, especially when we're at war with terrorists and we have Russia-China issues and that type of thing, that you can criticize, you can make judgments. But when you have a report, give at least the 2 hours, the 2 years, 2,000 hours, respect enough to read the report.
The Republicans contributed
and talk to your peers on it. It's bipartisan. They were in control of the committee. Remember, we're in the minority.
You're just the ranking member. Only the ranking member. Excuse me.
But we work together.
No, I agree with you. I mean, how rare is this? You've got Issa and Elijah Cummings going to battle over the IRS and nonprofits and the Tea Party. You know, they haven't come to any understanding about that. That war goes on.
Well, I think we came to a conclusion here.
Yeah.
And we did the right thing.
And then you got a Republican senator who calls it that word that I don't like to use on the air, even though I don't want to sound like a prude. I just think it's an inappropriate word, especially for a United States senator. 410-662-8780. A lot more to talk about with Dutch Ruppersberger. Congressman Ruppersberger is with us for the hour. Yesterday, Chuck Hagel resigned, or actually sounds like he was forced to resign, Secretary of Defense. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about ISIS, future of the Democratic Party, results of the Democratic election, of the election here, the midterms in Maryland.
Anything's on the table. Oh, I do want to read this one quote out of the report, but
I
think it's
we'll get back. We'll take a little break.
Oh,
we can do that when we get back.
I know you have to take a break.
But in the end, the New York Times writes today, reports today, Mr. Hagel's passivity.
We're live.
Okay. We're back on the air. Would you hear the music? That means we're back. Okay. Dutch Ruppersberger. Back.
Yeah.
This is midday. Dan Rogers here.
Okay.
This is the quote from the New York Times. Mr. Hagel's passivity and lack of support in Mr. Obama's inner circle proved too much for an administration that found itself back on a war footing. Back on a war footing with the president's decisions about Afghanistan and, of course, the battle with ISIS. So what do you make of the Secretary Chuck Hagel?
All fairness to Hagel, he was the first Secretary of Defense that had really served Vietnam. He was a veteran. He received a meritorious award for his valor. I think what Obama did and developed a relationship with him in the Senate is that he was more of a pacifist type individual, and he would have been the right person to deal with the downsizing of the military and getting us out of Afghanistan. And then all of a sudden you have Putin going crazy and attempting to do the things that he did in
Ukraine.
And then you had ISIS. And ISIS really just shook still people are concerned. I go to places right now, people are very concerned about ISIS. And I can talk about those details and other threats too if you want. And so I think that the president didn't like the way he was handling himself to the public, his message. And, you know, when you're the commander-in-chief of the United States, the strongest country in the world, you have to have confidence that you're really number one person in defense is going to be on the same wavelength and that the American public are going to have confidence, and that also your allies in the world are going to have confidence in this individual. And I think it really was a lack of confidence. It's unfortunate for Hagel because I don't think he did anything wrong. It was more his style.
And where do you think the president goes next for Secretary of Defense?
It depends.
Any ideas?
There are names that are out there. There's a deputy secretary right now. But it just depends on who he's vetting at the time. And the unfortunate thing, because the Congress is so political now and partisan, is that who is he going to be able to get confirmed? And that's what you have to look at. You might find the person that you think is the best and a person who's qualified, but you have to play the political game, which I think is unfortunate. As a former county executive, people have elected you. You should be able to hire the people that you feel most comfortable with to help run the government. And that's not the way it works anymore, unfortunately.
Representative Dutch Ruppersberger of Maryland, a Democrat from the 2nd District, is our guest in this hour at midday, 410-662-8780. You wanted to read a quote from the Benghazi report that we started off the hour discussing.
I think one thing that's important, and this is where, that despite the highly sensitive nature of these activities,
go ahead.
The report has endeavored to make the facts and conclusion widely and publicly available so that the American public can separate facts from the swirl of rumors and unsupported allegations. There's another thing that really bothered me about, and I try to be bipartisan, but when this committee, the committee, Benghazi committee, was put together, that their budget is a higher budget than our intelligence committee's budget. Our responsibility is to oversee the 17 intelligence agencies to do their budget, and yet their budget,
the special committee that special Boehner committee put together
will be allocated on an annual basis more money than our entire committee. And we have to do budget. I mean, I'm going to Iraq, Afghanistan, just got back from China on the cyber issues. We have a staff that works day and night overseeing these committees and doing their budget. So
why doesn't your report put an end to this?
Well, we'll see. Maybe it will, because this is the first bipartisan report that has come out that is well documented, 2,000 hours, totally bipartisan, and it was passed unanimously. That's another issue. It's following the facts, not following as what the senator said, following the crap.
Congressman, let's take a call from Charles in Baltimore. A question about the Secretary of Defense. Go right ahead, Charles. Hi.
Hello, Dan. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
I'm wondering if it's a good idea to replace the Secretary of Defense with a person who has no military experience or a person who has extensive military experience. Number one, we have civilian control of the military. Or number two, we have a person who can deal effectively with the Pentagon.
Well, that's a good question, but I think it depends on who the best person is at the time. If you don't have you might have military experience after your life. You might have somebody who's worked for Department of Defense but hasn't been in the military. I think it's the best person. It's like what we're doing in the Veterans Administration right now. We have a person who was a CEO of Procter & Gamble, one of the most successful companies that we have. We have somebody that knows how to manage. I think it's more about management abilities and the ability to make a change and a difference. And a good manager will hire the best people that they can. Now, by the way, the person from the defense graduated from West Point, but is a very qualified manager. I think part of the problem that I see in Washington is such a big bureaucracy, and I think that you need people with management experience. I think that's one of the things that Obama didn't do, that he, when he came in, he didn't have management experience. So that's fine. But he needed to hire people that had the management experience and that knew how to deal with and had experience in dealing with Congress and communicating with Congress and knew how to get his agenda through. And that really just didn't happen. So I think, though, that the president, these issues are so serious on our national security, ISIS issues, the things that are happening out there with Russia and China and cyber attacks. I think that the president needs someone that he has confidence in and he thinks can do the best job and help him as the commander-in-chief of our country.
There's a lot going on, Dutch, combating ISIS. You mentioned ISIS now a couple of times. The rebels who are fighting against Assad in Syria, the ongoing conflict with Ukraine, Russia and Ukraine. This month, I think we were supposed to withdraw the last of our troops from Afghanistan. That's not happening. So this is complicated.
Well, wait a minute.
Let's pick a little bit.
I think when you talk about that, we have to explain it.
Take that one first, then.
Okay, as far as our troops, we're going to have and we want to have our intelligence that we need. We want our experts that are there to help stand up and train and to make sure that this government that we have been basically running or working with, that they can stand up to Taliban and that we don't waste the American lives. And it's unfortunate so many lives that we've lost that we don't have input. But on the other hand, I think the American people don't want us in a 10-year war, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan. You know, and so we have resources that other people don't have.
We're already at 10 years just about, aren't we?
We're
passed 10 years.
And, you know, if you look back at history, unfortunately, you know, if we would have finished the job in Afghanistan instead of going into Iraq, and any history is going to tell, maybe things would be different because we had the world behind us because we were attacked. You know, we in the United States of America have never gone in and attacked a country that didn't attack us, and that's what happened in Iraq.
So you think we need to remain there to train forces as well?
We have certain people, consultants and people in the country that can help and make sure that we have that proper training, the resources that they do have. But we don't want to have fighters on the ground and continue on what we're doing now. Because we have other issues out there, too. Not only issues within our own country, but there's China issues. There's issues in South America. And remember, we have to continue to protect our country. And, you know, I believe that intelligence is the best defense against a lot of these issues. If you get the intelligence, then you know how to stop something before it gets started.
Let's talk about ISIS. I mean, that's gotten started. That's something we didn't see coming.
Well, let's talk about who ISIS.
What about intelligence on ISIS?
Let's talk about ISIS, who they are to begin with. ISIS was the former, a lot of the people there, and that's why they have such good command and control. A lot of them were the former members and officers in the Iraqi military that was fighting Iran. So they knew how to work tanks and weapons and that type of thing. And then when Syria, which is the most dangerous place in the world, and the Sunnis did not like Assad and the Shia and Hezbollah and that group, so they went in with al-Qaeda. They were part of al-Qaeda. They went into Syria. And then the people who Assad was killing, his own people, they're thinking, well, that's great. We have reinforcements. Well, they found out very quickly, you know, you don't get in bed with al-Qaeda. So then that caused another issue. But ISIS and their leadership got so radical that cutting heads off and doing things that were outrageous and raping women and all these things were occurring. And al-Qaeda says, this is not what we want. This is calling attention to things that we don't do as Muslims. We want to attack the West. We want to attack the Europe and the United States and that type of thing. So they had a break. But then ISIS was very smart. They have a lot of smart people. They started to obtain money through kidnappings and then they took control of oil, and they receive about $2 million a day just selling oil. Mm-hmm. And so they had command and control. And the interesting thing, which I think is going to hurt them in the end, it's the first terrorist group that really is trying to hold land. Most terrorist groups attack and leave. So they've got a lot on their plate as far as attempting to carry land.
They're trying to be a regional power.
Right, self-aid and that type of thing. But what happened and how they got the power?
The word state is in their name.
Right.
Islamic State of Iraq
exactly.
And Syria. Yeah.
And so then how they got to be stronger, too. They kept growing and getting money and growing and recruiting people and radicalizing people. They were strong in Syria, but then they went into Iraq. And the Sunnis in Iraq were really not treated well by the Maliki, who was in charge at the time, and he was Sunni. I mean, Shia. And he was Shia. And so he shoved out the Sunnis, he shoved out the Kurds, and then there was a lot of discourse. So the Sunnis, you know, they are seeing this ISIS coming around. They didn't fight with them, but they didn't stop them. Well, now they've become so radical, part of our policy to help come together to stop them is the Sunni tribes, and they're starting to work with us and our allies, and also the other Arab countries that are there. But these people, they're so gruesome in the things they do, cutting heads off. And
so if there is a U.S. strategy, I think you just described part of it, right?
Yeah.
You just described part of it. There's also missile and airstrikes, right?
We were the first entity to put them back on their heels when we did the airstrikes, and they worked. I mean, but eventually they won't continue to work because ISIS will get smart. They'll go into urban areas. We don't attack people for collateral damage, that type of thing. So, you know, you need boots on the ground. You need intelligence. We're not going to put our boots on the ground now. The only way we put boots on the ground is if we know that eventually is what's going to protect Americans. So we don't need to do that now. If it comes a time, you don't tell your enemy what you're doing anyhow. And that's part of what's out there. But we don't want the American people, my constituents, I don't believe, want another Iraq and Afghanistan again. We don't want another 10
so
years.
So you like the president's strategy?
Well, I don't say, I'm not going to really talk about it, the strategy. I think there's some things he can do and not do. I think the most important though, part of the strategy is to coordinate especially the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, which is really getting concerned about ISIS, Jordan, the Arab Emirates. And we're helping to train them to put boots on the ground. Now, we got to get back to Syria now, too, which is a very dangerous place. And Syria, the people there that we're trying to help and stand up are people that are losing their homes, or they're fighting for their lives and their families and that type of thing. So we're trying to help them. They're never going to be able to stand up against ISIS. But if we come together, get intelligence, and we start getting the Arab boots on the ground, I think it makes a difference.
Excuse me. Where is Assad in all this, then?
This is a real problem.
I mean, he's still in power,
Yeah, and he has about 15 lives. You know, cats have nine lives. He has 15 lives. I've met with a side by
that. I know. That's what I asked you about. And he's still there.
It's amazing. He's a very low-key optometrist. But let me get to a side. We're having issues with Turkey right now. I mean, the Turks, their priorities are, number one, to take out Assad. Number two, they don't like the Kurds. The Kurds are some of the best fighters that are working with us. They're standing up to ISIS because we've given the Kurds now the resources to stand up, and they're doing it pretty well. And so they don't like the Kurds. They see some of a Kurd group as actually terrorists. And then the third issue is ISIS. So what we have to do, and the vice president has been there, we're trying to get Turkey, Erdogan, their leadership, to say, look, you know, we don't like Assad either. But right now, we've got to deal with ISIS, and you need to deal with it. Because the problem is that all of these terrorists that are going to Syria are being radicalized. They're going through the borders of Turkey. Now, let me take this back to the United States and what concerns. One of my biggest concerns, you know, I'm a member of the Gang of Eight, and I know, you know, I'm the lead Democratic leader on intelligence, are the lone wolf type, the individuals in the United States who've been radicalized. And this is part of what ISIS is attempting to do. Every time they cut a head off, they see it to their advantage because they get media. And this is what they like to do. And they're getting a lot of recruits from this, believe it or not. I'll give you an example. There was an individual from Florida, and he went to Syria. He was radicalized. He was taught how to be a suicide bomber. Came home to visit his parents, and then left and came back, blew himself up, killed some people. He could have done the same thing in the United States. And because he has a passport, that causes us more problems. You know, we identify terrorists all over the world. NSA is as good at doing that as anybody. That's one of the best defenses we have. But the lone wolf and all these attacks that we almost had, the shoe bomber and that type of thing, they just didn't
Concern with Al-Qaeda.
Well, but Al-Qaeda—
And now you still have it with ISIS.
Well, ISIS, believe it or not, is a terrible threat to the world. But today, it's not as big of a threat as Al-Qaeda is, because there are groups of Al-Qaeda that right now are doing research and development. They're developing technology to have laptops and have plastic bombs. And the Khorasan group you've heard about, and we've been focusing on them. They're sophisticated. Their target is the United States or the European allies, and they're developing technology, and they are really focus more on attacking us today than ISIS is. ISIS' ultimate goal will be us, but right now they're just trying to hold on to land.
I think a lot of Americans have the impression that Al-Qaeda went away when
Al-Qaeda is still, and all over the world.
Yeah. Let's take a couple of calls.
Yeah, sure.
Dutch Rupersberger is our guest. Congressman Rupersberger, I have a couple more issues I want to address with him, but you can go right ahead and do that on the phone. 410-662-8780. Parker in Hagerstown, on a different subject here that we were going to get to. I think we were going to get to this. Go ahead, Parker.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
Congressman Rupersberger, I wanted to say thank you very much. 2 years ago, my brother passed away at Towson University, and I had the opportunity to meet you at a Veterans Garden dedication there.
Okay.
And I know it meant a lot for my family, and I wanted to say thank you for that.
Okay. My grandson's name is Parker also.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
I did have a question. I agree with you on almost all points in your voting stances, except I do disagree with your stance on net neutrality. And you've repeatedly voted against net neutrality and voted for the sharing of information from Internet service providers to the United States government. And I was just kind of wondering,
thing, I wouldn't confuse the net neutrality issue with my stance on the Intelligence Committee and what we do as far as protecting our country and the checks and balances.
Where are you on net neutrality?
Well, that's why I'm going to get to this, because this is the question he's asked. Net neutrality is now an issue. And here's what I have a concern. Here's an example where you have to go, I believe, you have to resolve the issue. And this is why. I feel that we need to protect the Internet. I feel that a major company, a big company, should not be able to control a smaller company that wants to, you know, like a Netflix, you know, Flick or something like that, that they don't. They have to pay certain money to whoever controls, like a Comcast or a Verizon or somebody like that, because I believe that's going to create costs and it's not fair to the public that they're going to control the internet basically. But where I do have an issue, and this is where we have to work some issues out, and there's a long way to go, and this is what debate is about in Congress, that you don't want to take away research and development and continue to move forward. Because if you have something totally overregulated, then you're not going to give an incentive to these businesses to continue on. So where I am right now, I think we have work to do on both sides. I have an issue with monopoly. I have an issue with a group like a Comcast being able to control who goes out to where we are, and that it's who pays the most money to Comcast.
Why does overregulation always become the word rather than just regulation? I mean, could you see regulating it like public utility?
I think overregulation.
Nobody favors overregulation, but that's a subjective thing.
But I would think that the term overregulation was mean when the government, if they're regulating, goes too far, and it takes away competition.
But what about regulation?
Well,
utility, like, as if it were a public utility.
Well, a public utility, and when it comes to this type of research and development and what's happening with the Internet and Google and that type of thing, you need some type of regulation so there's not monopoly and dominance.
Okay. Did Parker leave us? Because I was curious where he disagrees with you then.
We haven't really started to vote on net neutrality. That's right. My issue. There's a lot
of issues
out there.
Some people want it totally open and hands off completely.
But I think there needs to be some type of regulation. That's my point.
I want to ask you about the NSA bill on telephone records, but we're going to wait till after a break to get your answer on that. Dutch Ruppersberger is our guest. 410-662-8780 is the number. If you want to speak to the congressman, if you have a question for him, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks with Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger. So the other part of that question has to do with the NSA and the collection of metadata, all these telephone records. You and I talked about this a couple of times when you were on the air. I remember you're saying in order to find the needle in the haystack, you need to have the whole haystack. You change your position on that. You backed a bill, a House bill, that would prohibit the NSA from this massive collection of telephone records and force the NSA to come up with a better system of developing, develop an alternative method to gather this intelligence.
Yeah, we had metadata.
Yeah.
Metadata is someone's...
It's the haystack.
Yeah, it's someone's phone number, no address, no phone. You don't know who it is. Supreme Court has held that it's legal. But what happened, and I said the needle in the haystack, we didn't have a system before 9/11, and we didn't know these people were in the United States. So, now we had this system where you would have probably your number, my number, but again, nobody can identify you. After Snowden, and by the way, Snowden, in my opinion, is a traitor. He took the information that he had, gave it right away to the Russians and the Chinese. 90% of what he took, by the way, was military, and that didn't help us during Ukraine either. But let's get back on this.
Hey, let you get your shot in at Snowden. We're limited in time.
Okay, we are.
Because the Senate blocked this bill. That's what I want to get to.
Yeah, but let's say with the bill. I came up with a bill and to take the metadata away from the government and back where the phone companies, where we get it anyhow. And the bill basically would, and we brought in the privacy groups. We put together a good bill. I was able eventually to talk Chairman Rogers, Republican, to vote for the bill, and we got over 300 votes in the House, both Republican and Democrat. And it was a really good bill on both sides of the aisle. But what it would do basically is say if the NSA picked up a terrorist from Yemen calling the United States, NSA would give that to FBI because NSA doesn't have jurisdiction. FBI, under my bill, or Chairman Rogers, my bill, would then take that information. A court would look at it before and after and go to the phone company. And it would have to pass a test called RAS, an intelligence, reasonable, articulable suspicion. Okay, then that would allow, once they did that and the judge would rule that they passed that test, they go to the phone companies and allow two hops to see whether or not this terrorist was calling to another terrorist and whether they were planning an attack.
Two hops, meaning?
They could go beyond just the phone number they called, then whose phone number did that go,
and information.
Now, if in fact at any time, and the courts are involved, at any time that they were going to listen to an American, and this is where the Americans are protected, there would have to be a court order. No different than what we do for wiretaps, probable cause, and organized crime, drugs, that type of thing. And so we put together the bill. We had a lot of input. from the privacy groups. We created a special privacy group to assist the courts. We have checks and balances with my committee, with the Senate committee, with the Justice Department. I mean, we have more checks and balances than any other country in the world on what we're doing here. And we were able to, because we made the bill palatable. I have to protect, as a Democrat, the privacy issues and the constitutional rights. Got 300 votes. It was a miracle in this Congress that we got 300 votes. We went over to the Senate, and it just didn't go. And it's really unfortunate, because what's happened now, we thought, and Chairman Feinstein and Senator Feinstein, Senator Chambliss, Republican, Mike Rogers and I met last week, said, let's get this bill passed. It's a good bill, and it deals with privacy issues. And
what's the problem in the Senate?
Mitch
McConnell.
Yeah, but you know why? Because they got control, and they feel, Mitch McConnell said
on the floor,
that this bill is not strong enough and has too many privacy issues. He didn't say exactly that. He says it's not strong enough, and when we have control of the Senate.
It's not strong enough which way?
It's not strong
in terms
enough
of protecting people?
It's not, yeah. They feel, and I look, I care about my country. I have worked this. I represent NSA. They're in my district. And yet we have to, NSA has not broken any laws, but there was a perception they did. So we have to deal with the issue of privacy, and we did. We brought in liberals on our Judiciary Committee, and Chairman Rogers, I give him credit, was able to deal with this bill that we put on the floor, over 300 votes, and it's lingered in the Senate. We thought we were going to get it moving in the lame duck. And McConnell felt, nope, we need a stronger bill, which means there'll be less privacy.
Do you believe
rights.
Him? Do you believe
no,
that's
No, I think
why
our bill was a great bill.
Or was he just exerting his new...
I think that they felt that there were too many possibly privacy provisions in the bill that they felt they couldn't go for. And you need balance. You need checks and balances. And it's very upsetting to both Rogers and... Because Rogers is retiring. I'll probably be going back to the Appropriations Committee because I'm... 8 years and 4 years. Pelosi could keep me if she wants, but usually you're termed out after 12 years.
So you're coming
years.
Off the Intelligence
well,
Committee?
Well, I hope I can stay, but I think that I'm basically termed out. It's no law. It's just Pelosi's call. But if not, I'll be going to appropriations where I'll be dealing with the same issues only from an appropriation side.
Politics. After this election, people looking around and saying, what's up with the Democrats? They look like they're a mess.
Democrats can't get their message out. We believe in a lot of positive things, helping children, education, you know, equal rights, minimum wage.
You run away from the Affordable Care Act. Democratic candidates wouldn't even talk about that. There was one who ran against McConnell who wouldn't acknowledge whether she voted for Barack Obama.
Because the Republicans were better controlling the message. But here's what happens. If you look at history, every eight-year president in his last two terms, his party always loses. It goes back to Eisenhower.
And it happened in 2006.
Yeah, happens all the time. Yeah. And I think people are really hurting now. You know, this in the United States of America, the top 1%, there's the biggest discrepancy between the top 1% in wealth and middle class. And that means middle class is still hurting. And middle class is sick of Congress, you know, fighting and not getting things done, and not voting on bills and that type of thing. So if it was Republican and as president, I think it would have happened the other way. And we just weren't focusing on what people cared about. People in this election, they didn't care about abortion. You're going to care about it one way or the other. They didn't care about a lot of the things that we talk about. They cared about who's going to come together with a plan and help me protect my family, buy food, give me a job that's going to make a difference. And they weren't seeing that. And I think that's what happened. And I think it's what happened in the state of Maryland, too.
The state of Maryland? And let me ask you right off the bat. Do you regret not running for governor?
No. I look back. I came very close. My polling numbers are very high, and I loved being county executive. But I have a job to do now. I get up in the morning. I love my job. I feel I have expertise in cyber and space and NSA and all those issues, and it's a very dangerous world. And I think that this is
so
where
you
I should
don't
be.
Regret not getting into the primary.
I really don't. A lot of people have been coming, and you have to run again. And I said no. You know, and I also look. I've got grandkids. There's seven.
One's named Parker, right?
Two. Yeah, and one named Camden after Camden Yard, but they live out of state. And let me say this. And one's name is Libby, the little girl. But the bottom line is that when you get to a certain age, you want to be able to deal with your family, and you know you want to be able to do the things you like. I love the action. I think I'm doing whatever I can to protect our country. But
I could be that on election night. I heard you tell a reporter that Anthony Brown did not define himself.
That's the problem. Anthony Brown, and he was a good man. I didn't support him in the beginning. He asked me to support him. I think what happened is that he had professionals running his campaign that didn't know the state of Maryland. You know, they might have known national politics. And I said, your ads are vanilla. You're not identifying. You're military. I literally paid for an ad for him in the end when he asked me
to
support him.
His ads were negative.
Well,
you're talking about the ones that were, bland?
In the beginning were bland.
But then he started attacking Larry Hogan. And for Larry Hogan, it might have served the purpose of name recognition. A lot of people didn't even know who Larry Hogan was.
But look at what happened. You know, when he attacked him on abortion, which is people aren't going to change their minds on abortion wherever you are, and then allow a really good ad about his daughter. Then how about the ads that he had where he had a brown second string to O'Malley, and he's going to be able to raise taxes. And taxes were an issue because economy was an issue. Jobs were an issue. Brown, I tried to get Brown to come over to Dundalk and areas like that. He came to Dundalk once, and he was well-received. But people didn't know he was a leader. He was military. He just didn't identify himself. And one of the first things in politics, you have to identify yourself to the people if you want them to vote for you. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, he was a decent person. I mean, he tried the best that he could, but the campaign didn't go where it needed to go.
Generally speaking,
and it was also a wave, national and local.
In terms of defining the definition, the political definition, do you think the Democrats have this problem? I ask you because of what I said earlier. People, candidates run away from Obama. They run away from the Affordable Care Act. You and other members of Congress have money that you didn't really need to spend on campaigns. You could spend the money on TV commercials telling people to go sign up for health insurance and bragging about the ACA. I don't see Democrats doing that.
Well, it depends on where you are. In the state of Maryland, we got a wake-up call because we were so Democratic. And it was just almost an example of what happened. Politics is what happened in Dundalk.
Democratic. You don't define what being a Democrat is.
Well, you know, I think there are different types of Democrats. I'm perceived to be more of a moderate pro-business Democrat because I believe jobs are important. I believe, you know, I was a former prosecutor. Then you have other guys. But I'm a Democrat because I care about social issues. I care about kids. I care about helping people. You know, when I was going to law school, I worked in inner city. I saw the issues that needed to be dealt with. But there's some other things. I'm a strong manager.
Why do Democrats run away from the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think Democrats are so diverse, it's hard for us to come together, where Republicans stick together on everything and they got a great message.
And they say their great message is what? No?
Well, first thing, the Affordable Care Act is something that had to be dealt with, and this is the message that doesn't get out. If we did nothing in 10 years, the average premium per family would be $25,000 a year. And people didn't get that. The concept of insurance is as many people in the pool as you can. And I think if you look at the figures right now, the Affordable Care Act isn't doing bad. But what did Democrats do? In the state of Maryland, here we have NSA, some of the top technology in the world. We hire a company from North Dakota, and we fail. Then the Republicans shut the government down, cost us $25 billion. They made us weaker. And if we couldn't take them out on that one issue, and then a week later, Obamacare falls because we didn't test it. We didn't have the technology necessary. And that's what happened. We lost
that. Admit it. It seems like the Republicans don't want to govern, and the Democrats, who are the party of government, don't do it that well.
Well,
that's what it looks like right now.
I think there are plenty of Democrats who can manage. I think unfortunately, you're not going to make this. I think the national media has control of a lot of the way people think, whether you're Fox on one side or MSNBC on another. If you talk to a lot of people, where do you get your information? I'm not saying everybody does.
But Fox dominates.
Well,
the Fox message dominates. To compare it to MSNBC, it's a midget compared to a giant.
But there's an issue that is out there. And I travel a lot on my role in the Intelligence Committee. We have the best country in the world. You want to kiss the ground every day you come home. Then you're home for 2 weeks, and you hear Fox or hear MSNBC. See, what are we doing to ourselves? Right. You know what it is? This is what's got happening in Congress. In the old days, you used to be able to like people. And if they had a different point of view, you respected them. Now, if you have a different point of view, you're the enemy. That's wrong.
And they use words like crap on the air.
Yeah, well,
to talk about your work.
I'll try to get back.
Okay. You try to get back to Lindsey Graham for that. Well, Dutch Ruppersberger, thank you very much. I enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah,
appreciate you making time on your holiday break here. And have a great Thanksgiving with your family.
I will eat some turkey and dressing and sauerkraut and all that stuff.
Root for Loyola.
And wasn't that a great game last night?
Yeah. Who do you root for on Thanksgiving Day?
I'm a City College guy.
That's City College, right.
Yeah, and I used to play in the Poly City game on Thanksgiving Day. It was great. With George Young, my coach.
That's right.
Yeah,
then he went to the New York Giants.
Became general manager. Yeah. And then head of operations for the NFL. Joe Brune, who went to Loyola, was his assistant.
Dutch, have a great holiday.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Thank you, everybody.
Right.
We'll see you again tomorrow for another midday.
Okay, got it.